holster that wrapped around the hired gun's body glove, like it was a part of his enhanced musculature. The broker was exactly as his or her name suggested. A trafficker, a very exclusive purveyor of goods, introductions, and favours. Finding them had been difficult, getting a meeting even more so. Hell's Red Sword would testify to that. The initial business had been conducted through factotums and underworld intermediaries, and now it came to it at last. Mulgravia realised she had no idea how to identify the broker. Wealth, she assumed, was as good a barometer as any, and so she made for the fat man's orbit, but stopped when she felt a light touch on the arm. She turned sharply, slipping a hand beneath her long coat, sliding fingers around the hilt of the combat knife tucked behind her back. Even in the dingy light, she saw the hard living in the scars of the man in front of her. He had swarthy skin, with a soldier's cut, hair shorn short around the temples and a little longer on the crown, and wore hardy travelling fatigues. A duster coat was swept over the back of the seat he had vacated, along with a gun belt that holstered a pair of ivory-handled auto-pistols. A ruddy, ragged scarf looped round his neck, and there were small plates of armour stitched into his jerkin. Catching Mulgravia's gaze, he lifted his hand to show her both palms in a placatory gesture. "No trouble here," he said in a low drawl. He had the look of a Badlands drover, a cattleman. Either that, or he was ex militarum. "Not for me, anyway," she warned him, relaxing her grip, but not letting go of the knife. "So long as you stay away from Farkum, then sure." Something in Mulgravia's expression must have suggested confusion, because the drover, or whatever he was, decided to elaborate. "The fat man, draped in gold, with his own harem. You don't want anything from him." She stepped in closer, so barely half an arm length stood between them. "And how do you know what I want?" The drover rubbed the bristles on his chin, as if appraising something. "I know he ain't it." "I suspect you know very little. What do you want?" Mulgravia wondered if Hell might put in an appearance, but it wouldn't have been the first time she had let her fend for herself. The drover smiled, but she cut his charm to the quick when the knife pricked at his throat. "This is a monomolecular cleaving blade," she told him. They were close enough to kiss, but Mulgravia had something much deadlier in mind. "It can cut through carapace like parchment." "Push hard enough," she said, leaning in so the tip nicked the drover's skin to let a crimson bead roll gently down the blade, "and it can even penetrate adamantium and ceramite. Do you know what kind of warriors wear armour like that?"
"I most certainly do," replied the drover, maintaining his easy charm despite the knife held to his neck. "I can see you are a serious woman, and I have no wish to incur your ire further. But I believe we may be at cross purposes."
"Is that so?"
"It is."
"And are you going to tell me why I shouldn't push 10 inches of monomolecular plasteel through your larynx? Or shall I just begin?"
"A very serious woman," said the drover, and took a slow, backward step, and then another to the side. A booth had opened up behind him,
one that hadn't been there before. He smiled again, gesturing to the booth like a major domo shepherding a guest of his master's household.
"The broker will see you now."
They entered the fog bank east of town, having gained the ridge and hurried past the shadow of Wrecker's Curve. The old bridge was still visible behind them, its broken edge sagging into the gully like a flaccid tongue.
"Saints, blood, this came in fast," Corinna remarked as the yellow morass closed in around them,
and she began to think they weren't moving fast enough. Something had happened in the gully. Her father had seen it and wasn't talking. She had no desire to return to Meager. That place hadn't been home for a long time, but her choices were limited. Even still, she recognised the shacks made from scavenged metal and the grain silos raised up on stalks that marked the border. She had crossed it enough times. Broken agri-servitors paced the fields of hard earth, digging irrigation channels with their shovel-like hands. She hated them with their idiot expressions and pallid skin. A red-scaled raptor alighted onto the head of one of the creatures and began pecking out the soft jelly of its eyes. Corinna's lip curled in disgust. Such toil, to gain so little. A few of the servitors had collapsed, left to disrepair, their joints rusted through. Rot tainted the air. Blind to the strangers in their midst, they paid them no heed.
"You hear that?"
Christo had stopped partway through one of the fields and turned his head, frowning as he tried to listen. Corinna couldn't hear anything beyond the misery and industrial churn of Meager.
"If you mean the soulless, beating heart of this shit heap, then yeah, I hear it."
Christo appeared not to acknowledge her, but kept turning his head, first east, then west. The fog thickened by the moment, and soon it would be difficult to tell one direction from another.
"What is it?"
He was scaring her, though she wasn't about to admit that. Something haunted him, like an old ghost hungry for his blood. Then she heard it, muffled by the fog. Footsteps, coming fast, lots of them. Then, heavy, rabid, breathing. Corinna felt a bead of sweat trickle down the small of her back. Her heartbeat felt like a storm battering her chest. She understood what was wrong with a sickening and despairing clarity. He was afraid, desperately afraid. Though they were at odds, she had always respected his fearlessness. He had fought to keep them alive in Meager. No daughter should ever see her father scared. It went against nature. But with a profound feeling of unease, she realised that whatever was out there in the fog went against nature too. She gripped his hand, hers still bound in the bandages from the fight.
"Father?"
He turned to face her, his expression confused, as if he couldn't remember who she was. Then he squeezed her hand back, and together they ran. The agri-servitors toiled in their wake, solemn as mourners and oblivious to what came after. Chapter 4. Riot. Sirens wailed throughout Meager. Proctors marched the streets, a veritable army of the bastards, bellowing through loud hailers and herding the scared populace like cattle. Curfew had been ordered. Citizens ran for their domiciles with the fervour of rats fleeing fire. Mothers clutched babes to their chests. Weak and fearful men looked to their own safety. Families huddled close, desperate to stay together. The churn of humanity ploughed ahead in a nervous mob, obeying the blaring of the horns, willingly ignorant of the false protection the proctors offered. As they made for their own hab, Christo and Corinna had little choice but to be swept up in the mayhem.
"Have you ever seen so many?"
she asked, reckoning on about 200 of the lawkeepers, rank after rank of black carapace, helms and tower shields.
"They're more afraid than we are." "Not since the grain riots,"
Christo replied, and looked hounded by his thoughts. They were moving slowly through one of the main thoroughfares, hemmed in by bodies, the air tinged with fear, but still short of outright panic. Corinna dreaded to imagine the slaughter if the herd decided to stampede.
"What did you see?"
she said, as they were pressed close, whispering into his ear so they weren't overheard.
"In the gully. What was it?"
Christo shook his head, staring as if whatever he had witnessed replayed before his mind's eye.
"Not sure."
"Yes, you are. You know exactly what you saw. You just don't want to say it.
Because that would make it real. Christo had been about to answer when a shout came from behind them. One of the proctors was reacting to something. He gave a few curt orders, and a section of their ranks peeled off to deal with an unseen threat. They headed east.
The fields,
said Corinna, meeting her father's wild gaze. He grabbed her wrist.
I'm getting us out.
She let him pull her along as he pushed through the crowd. The shouting grew worse and quickly turned into screaming. A proctor yelled through his loud hailer.
Disperse! Disperse!
Shotgun discharge thundered, the dull percussive booms overlaying each other in a desperate chorus. Now the crowd was running, scrambling, falling. Corinna, half dragged by her father, saw a docker disappear into the mass of bodies. He didn't rise again. She felt a sharp pain in her ribs, hands grasping at her hair and clothes, pulling her back like a human riptide. Lashing out, her elbow struck bone and the pulling eased. Christo drove on like a battering ram, one hand clamped to his daughter, the other tearing at the undulating wall of bodies standing in their way. Blood flecked his face and hands. He roared, savage, driven. A grey canister spiralled into the air, and Corinna just caught sight of it as it descended, corkscrewing smoke, before detonating right in the midst of the throng. Tear gas spewed out in a dense cloud. More screaming followed, both pain and terror. Half a dozen more canisters arced towards the crowd, fired from grenade launchers. Corinna watched their slow parabolas with increasing horror as one landed a few feet away.
Oh, thrown!
A surge of light and heat struck her, and she lost her father's grip as the blast took her sideways. Dazed, prone, her ears ringing, it took Corinna a few seconds to realise that it wasn't tear gas. The proctors were hurling frag grenades. They were trying to decimate the crowd and remove it as an impediment. A factorum worker, face burnt black, overalls shredded and bleeding from a dozen shrapnel wounds, staggered and fell right in front of her. A mother, in the robes of a low-level scrivener, cast about for a missing child. Those caught in the explosion milled around, clutching the stumps of ruined limbs, searching for the pieces of them that were missing. Others wailed, blinded, bloodied, and afraid. Stillness briefly reigned, the passing seconds abruptly stalled by the shock of the recent present. Then everything came crashing back, the fear and the agony, a river of it tearing through its banks and letting loose a flood. Corinna sat up and screamed,
"Murdering bastards! You're killing us! You're killing us!"
She tried to rise and got struck by a flailing leg. The city spun, blurring. East became west as she stumbled and fell hard. Pain seared through her knee, burning needles piercing the bone, and she yelped. She rose again, unsteady, until a blow to her midriff put her on her back. Groaning, panic and desperation filling her gut with ice, Corinna rolled over. Then she crawled, elbows dragging, blood fogging one eye and turning everything she looked at an ugly shade of crimson. She perceived legs desperately scurrying and the cold faces of the dead staring from the heaps of bloody bodies. A foot thudded into her back and she gasped as the breath was punched violently from her body. She kept crawling, but got kicked in the chin. Starbursts erupted across her vision as a copper taste filled her mouth. Corinna reached for her knife. At least she could die fighting, but grasped an empty scabbard. Proctors scrambled as all pretense of order devolved into a desperate fight to survive. They were killing now. Corinna watched them through the gaps in the panic, scything through the citizens of Meager like butchers culling cattle. Mauls rose and fell, slick and bloody, riot shields crushed and bludgeoned, loud hailers fell, discarded, shotguns replaced them. Amidst the scrum of bodies, Corinna caught a glimpse of what had terrified the proctors. And suddenly, her father's fear made perfect, horrific sense. Another mob. But this one ran towards the carnage, their eyes glaring with feral hunger.
A tide hit the proctors, pulling, tearing, biting. Death swept through Meager. Corinna fought. She kicked and thrashed and punched until she lurched to her feet. She found her knife, Providence, skittering it back within her reach, and held the blade before her like a torch to ward off the dark. Except the dark could not be kept at bay. It would engulf the town and everyone in it. The dimmed lamps in the booth framed a slight-looking figure in dark blue robes. The figure wore a deep hood to hide its face, but the dull flicker of augmetics caught the light. The figure's hands, concealed in the folds of voluminous sleeves at first, shone with a metallic glint as it steepled mechanical fingers. Mulgravia glanced at the drover. In lieu of a name, she had come to think of him as such, who dabbed at the wound on his neck with a cloth. Then she looked back at the robed figure, apparently waiting for her. "You're the broker," she said, a statement of fact, not an interrogative, and took the seat opposite. The robed figure gave a shallow nod. Close up, it was possible to discern that the broker was female, or at least the parts of her that were still flesh and blood. "You're a data smith," Mulgravia realized. "Or at least, you used to be." Another nod confirmed it. "So, what now?" asked Mulgravia. At a curt gesture from the broker, a servitor in a sweeping velvet robe brought over two long-stemmed crystal chalices. Far from the gruesome automata that toiled in the labour pits or the holds of void ships, the creature looked almost civilized, though its visible skin was utterly devoid of hair and its gender impossible to determine. Apart from an odd, dewy complexion, the only concessions to its otherness were a small aural circuit chip behind its left ear and a hexagonal, ruby-like vox emitter that had been fitted into a brass torque around its neck. "Incarnadine wine," the servitor explained, in an incongruous, urbane voice. Only one of the chalices had any liquid in it, a dark substance that put Mulgravia in mind of blood. "I'll pass, if it's all the same to you." The servitor paused, its courtesy protocols momentarily wrong-footed, before retreating back into the shadows with its offering.
"As you wish. I had thought a drink before we begin," offered the broker,
once the servitor had become one with the bar's dubious ambience. Her voice was resonant, almost mechanistic. Mulgravia raised an eyebrow. "You do speak, then?"
"I speak."
"Fortunate, given your line of work, though I suppose your sommelier could act as an intermediary."
"I am the intermediary," she replied. "That is my function."
"Is buying your clients a drink part of the transaction too?"
"It can be, though you won't drink with me." "Neither of us are drinking."
"Ah, but I'm thinking you never drink."
"I have no need to. Though I do appreciate the ritual, if not the actual imbibing," she conceded, interlacing her fingers. "But I do not believe you are interested in my habits."
"On the contrary, I always like to know with whom I am dealing."
"That's a formal and antiquated way to put it."
"I am from a very formal and antiquated profession. One of the oldest, in fact."
"I see. Perhaps that bodes well for our transaction, then."
"Too early to tell," though I have taken some pains to arrange this meeting. Mulgravia glanced around. I admit, I'm surprised you chose this place.
What's surprising about it?
The broker's keen, artificial eyes remained intent on Mulgravia's. She had yet to blink.
It is a public establishment, but one of questionable moral repute. I can imagine there are many in here who would take issue with a profession as, how did you put it? Formal and antiquated as yours.
Mulgravia smiled thinly. Does your drover not provide you with adequate protection? The drover had finished tending to his wound and gave Mulgravia a wink as she glanced at him.
Does your death cultist? I assume she is lurking here somewhere.
Mulgravia hid her surprise behind a curt laugh and chose to bluff. She's as near as I need her to be, she said.
I see. He is not a drover, by the way.
Of course he isn't. He dresses like one, though. The broker appraised her gun hand, as if doing so for the first time, then looked back to Mulgravia.
I concur. He does.
Does he have a name?
That is highly likely.
Do you?
I am the broker.
I see, said Mulgravia, her expression neutral.
Do you? See, I mean.
Mulgravia decided upon a different tack and wagged a remonstrating finger. You've been watching me.
As you say, I am a datasmith. My currency is information, and information keeps me alive.
And rich. I assume the gun hand and the silky major domo aren't your only servants.
And rich, the broker reiterated,
though Mulgravia caught a flash of something. Anger? In her eyes. Her next sentence confirmed it.
I have enjoyed our parley, but I believe one of us is perhaps wasting the other's time.
That's an astute observation.
Indeed, the only thing I do not comprehend is why.
Information keeps me alive, too.
That is reasonable. But perhaps we should move to business. Shall we begin with you confirming what it is that you want?
The broker paused, laying her hands down upon the table.
Assuming, of course, you can get what I want.
Passage, off-world, on a rogue trader vessel. Undocumented, uninhibited. Yes, it is within my means to grant you this favour.
And I am to take this on faith?
How's this for faith? Said Mulgravia, and showed her inquisitorial rosette. A tremor of unease rippled through the broker at the sigil that had condemned heretics and witches to death and torture the galaxy over. Mulgravia took no small amount of satisfaction from watching the broker squirm.
That will more than suffice, she said, gently clasping her hands over the rosette to hide it, a silent urging for her companion to put it away. We can proceed.
I'm glad we could establish a measure of trust, Mulgravia said, returning the Ordo sigil to the folds of her long coat.
I would not say that.
Mulgravia gave a mock frown. You hurt my feelings.
I sincerely doubt that, said the broker. Your terms, then.
First, I want to know why you want passage off-world.
You definitely live up to your profession's namesake, the broker replied, trying to hide her annoyance. Why does it matter?
Why does anything matter? I don't know yet, but if I am to do this for you, then I would like to know for what reason you need a ship.
Let us just say
that in my trade, I make certain people nervous. Knowledge is power, and there is nothing the powerful fear more than knowledge. I have an abundance of it. Mulgravia's eyes brightened with a sudden revelation. So that's why you wanted us to meet here. You're in hiding, aren't you? The broker's silence answered for her. You took a sizable risk by treating with someone like me, said Mulgravia.
I have. I am. Now, you know my reasons. So all that remains are your terms. If you please.
Mulgravia stared at the broker, still weighing and measuring. She had little choice, though. In 31 days, she had not found a better lead, and the fact that the broker was scared enough to make this deal with her when she knew she was being hunted went some way to assure her of its authenticity.
I have been...
She tried to find the right word. Compromised. My memories are incomplete. This is a state I cannot allow to continue.
Because you too are hunted.
Mulgravia saw no point in dissembling further. I believe so, yes. My business here is my own, and you want no part of it. But I cannot conclude it without
your memories. You say I would want no part in your business here. But you cannot say truly what that business is. The heretic, or mutant, or witch you were hunting, is unknown to you. Your purpose here, likewise. It puts you at great risk, and I think, perhaps, you have already fallen foul of these men or women before.
Mulgravia felt herself tense, self-reflexively, at the reference to her obvious physical injuries, the scarring on her hands and face, all too apparent, even in the dingy light of the bar.
How do you know they are men and women?
That is true. Then let me correct myself and say, the parties whom you are hunting, and now hunt you, inflicted this hurt, and it was they who shattered the mirror of your memories also.
Are you asking me or telling me?
I believe you know the difference, Inquisitor.
Mulgravia held the broker's gaze, putting a little steel in it. The datasmith's augmetic fingers tapped the table nervously.
I am in touch with an unsanctioned...
The Ordo I serve is not interested in rogue psychers. Tell me about the witch.
She is called the Empath.
Mulgravia scoffed. Really? Do any of you in this business have actual names?
For someone used to the precautions of a clandestine agency, I am surprised you have to ask.
Mulgravia shrugged, then said, The Empath, you were saying.
She is what is sometimes regarded as a psychic chirurgeon. I know her whereabouts and can ensure an audience.
I don't need an audience, snapped Mulgravia, harder than she intended. I need my mind restored. Can she do that?
She can do that. If she's assured your intent is not hostile.
How do you know my intent won't be hostile?
That measure of trust you mentioned. And I can detect your desperation.
Mulgravia wondered what else the broker's augmetics could discern, acutely aware of the risk she was taking, and still wondering what had become of Hell. She was about to ask how she would make contact, when a sudden scream made her turn. A drunk had staggered in from the outside or some other part of the bar and was wrestling with one of Farkum's courtesans. The girl screamed, struggling in her assailant's grip. Addled by obscure smoke, the fat merchant was slow to realise the transgression against what he regarded as his property, but
But now he cursed and spat, incensed at the interruption to his revels. He snarled something in a foreign tongue, prompting his hired gun to step into the fray and draw his weapon. The hired gun barged in, jacked on stims, sweeping out his flechette pistol like it was a badge of authority.
"Release the chattel,"
he growled, exuding violence. The girl staggered, having wriggled free. She was gasping for breath, pale with trauma. As she turned, the coal and rouge bleeding down her tear-streaked face, Morgravia realized why. Then everything changed. The courtesan clung to her own severed forearm, like a marionette, showing its broken parts to its master and not understanding why it was broken. The joint had been bitten through. Arterial blood painted the vicinity, and the chaos began. Chapter 5. Shotgun. Christo knew his daughter was about to die. She knelt in the middle of the main street, a lonely light surrounded by darkness and about to be snuffed out. Proctors surged past her, oblivious. They fled with utter abandon now, throwing off helms, breastplates, discarding anything that could slow them down. A few even dropped their weapons, a crime punishable by death, according to the book of the law, the Lex Imperialis. Something worse than death followed them, a hungering tide that slowed only to feast on flesh. Back in the gully, Christo had tried to deny it. He knew of men who had eaten the dead, explorators who had ventured into the ash wastes in search of fortune. Cannibalism was not an uncharted map. It had history. Certain dubious cults, those amongst the Outlander tribes as well as others, venerated the flesh, believing it passed on the strength and memories of the owner. This, whatever it was, defied definition. They lingered just beyond the far edge of the crowd, an undulating host, killing, feeding. Christo had made it to the edge of the road, but as the crowd thinned, either dead, dying, or scattered, he saw a way back. He ran, upending a proctor who had the misfortune of getting in his way. The proctor's helm came loose as he hit the ground, revealing little more than a youth, his face chalk-white with fear. He didn't fight and limped away, leaving his combat shotgun where it fell. Christo took it, holding the weapon in both hands as he barreled into the mob. He barged into a rake-thin scrivener, heaving the man aside, then smashed a dockhand with the butt of the shotgun. Someone grasped for the weapon, so he struck out with an elbow and they fell back. In his urgency to get to his daughter, Christo barely registered any of it. Corinna had a knife held out in front of her, and a burly proctor was about to trample her, when Christo wrapped an arm around her midriff and hauled her clear. He let off a burst from the shotgun, keeping his aim high. It served its purpose as the crowd screamed and scattered out of his way. They reached the side of the street, and Christo pulled her into a side alley, guarding the entrance after he put her down. No one followed.
"Are you hurt?"
he asked, and glanced over his shoulder. Fleeing bodies rushed past the side alley in a frantic blur. One stumbled and died beneath the feet of those that followed. Corinna rose unsteadily, her fingertips touching her ear, and coming back wet and crimson.
"Think I hit my head."
Then she fell. Christo cried out, slinging the shotgun over his shoulder on its strap as he ran to his daughter. Then, for the second time that day, for the second time in only the last 5 years, he swept her up into his arms.
"I'll get help. Hang on, Corinna,"
he said, and ran. Farkum gagged as the girl collapsed, her vitae jetting over his face and general corpulence. The hired gun cried out as the blood lanced across his eyes and he desperately scrabbled to clear his vision. What he saw, what everyone saw, defied belief. The attacker had been human once, female, but was now undeniably inhuman, like the myths of changelings taking on the appearance of their victims. Something else inhabited the flesh now. Her red eyes gleamed hungrily from a gaunt and shrunken face. Pallid skin clung to her emaciated skeleton like shriveled parchment as she crouched over the girl, stripping the bone clean with a hurried, eager gnawing. Bloodspittle flecked her chin and smeared her mouth. Whatever crude sentience remained in that cadaver-like shell became aware of being watched. Her head jerked up, agitated, rabid, and she glared between greasy strands of lank hair. Mulgravia reached for her weapon, having seen enough, and made for the creature. Farkoum threw aside the courtesan that had been fawning on his lap. She yelped, hitting the floor hard, but the merchant could have been discarding a glass for all the regard he paid her. The last courtesan he barged aside, trying to put as much distance between himself and the cannibal thing, gorging on the least fortunate of his harem.
"Kill it!"
he spat in heavily accented Gothic. The hired gun experienced a moment's pause before his master reiterated in the most strenuous of terms,
"Fucking kill it!"
The hired gun pulled the trigger, lacing the air with dozens of scything discs. They ripped through the stricken girl, turning her to chunks of meat, and cut down a slew of patrons unlucky enough to be in the way. The cannibal took the brunt of it, her torso shredded and one arm torn off. She reeled with the impact of the flechettes, but did not fall. Either she could withstand the immense pain, or simply didn't feel it. Drooling blood, her mouth matted with gore, she dropped the bone and sprang towards the nearest warm body. Her teeth clamped around the soft flesh of a dockhand's neck, and the man shrieked. She clung to him, arms and legs wrapped around his body as she bit down savagely. He thrashed briefly, but then was still. Pain and panic took hold. There were perhaps 30 patrons in the bar, and Mulgravia battered through most of them, shoving people aside as they scurried or hid. Her pistol led the way, but she couldn't get a good shot through the terrified throng. The drover was ahead of her, taking aim, twin auto pistols quickly in his grasp. He shot the cannibal thing through the forehead before Farkum's hired gun could unleash further collateral damage. She fell this time and did not rise again. He slickly holstered his pistols, twirling them with the panache of a Carnivali gunslinger. Then exchanged a look with the hired gun, who said gruffly,
"I had it handled."
"Sure you did," answered the drover,
a glance taking in the carnage the flechette burst had left in its wake.
"I reckon you'd have killed another 6 people before you got your mark, but you'd have done it all right.
Good for you."
The hired gun stepped right up to the drover, eyes bulging with fear, trembling with adrenaline from the stims. He had a roughly shaved face, the stubble an affectation rather than laziness. A slabbed forehead protruded slightly, an indication of a primordial mindset. Carefully cut cheekbones had been crafted cosmetically, and his black hair was sculpted, a coiled serpent shaved into the left temple, the symbol of the consortium whom he served. His custom body glove had fibre tracing like sinews that enhanced strength. It reeked of sweat.
"Want to make something of it?"
The drover smiled, feigning charm.
"Now you look like the kind of man with an enlarged amygdala.
Is that the case? Are you suffering from an overabundance of aggression, my friend?"
The hired gun's finger twitched on his sidearm, and he looked like he might use it, until he felt the pinch of a heavy-gauge stub pistol in his side.
"I would not advise that,"
Mulgravia said with quiet menace. She jabbed the pistol harder.
"At this range, that fancy body glove might as well be parchment. Let it go."
"Karaza!"
The hired gun turned at the mention of his name, Farkoum summoning his lackey. The other courtesans cowered near his bulk, too afraid to move, staring glassy-eyed at the bloody remains of their former associate. Grunting an expletive at the drover, the hired gun obeyed his paymaster and returned to his side. Mulgravia watched him depart.
"A man could get ideas, seeing a woman come to the rescue like that."
Inwardly, Mulgravia groaned.
get some different ideas. The drover smiled, not remotely dissuaded. You don't look like a hired gun, she said, scornful.
Not everyone is always what they seem.
Sighing, Mulgravia took in the situation. As of yet, none of the patrons had fled, which she took to be a good sign. They looked nervous, but curiosity overrode their fear as a few shuffled closer to the corpse killed by the drover. Mulgravia crouched by her side. In death, she appeared relatively ordinary. There were no obvious mutations, and she didn't bear a witch's mark or evidence of possession. This was no alien horror or plaything of the demonic. It was a woman, a bullet maker, judging by soot stains on her fingers and burn marks on her upper arms.
Ever seen something like that?
The drover had sunk down next to her, the fragrance of some balm or oil wafting off his skin. It was not unpleasant, Mulgravia decided, finding his presence less irritating, given his sudden sincerity. Tell me what you see, she said.
Nothing. And that's the strange thing. She's just a low hiver. I thought maybe a stimmer or obscura addict with a bad hatch, but...
He shrugged.
She's ordinary.
She is far from ordinary. Mulgravia felt his regard as he turned.
I'm thinking you have some idea then.
And you're hoping I share that with you?
Oh, I know you can't say anything here. Not with these folks gathering like sump flies around shit.
He smiled, and Mulgravia's ire rose anew.
But perhaps later?
There is no later.
I am afraid that is not entirely accurate.
The broker had emerged from the shadows, the exceptional circumstances pushing her into the open.
A cipher will verify your credibility to the empath. Without it, she will not treat with you.
Mulgravia scowled, her wrathful gaze moving from the broker to the drover. I assume he has it.
Yes.
The drover gave her a playful wink.
Like I said, later.
Then he frowned, his expression clouding.
You hear that?
He said, drawing his guns as he looked towards the entrance. Faint at first, it grew louder with each passing second.
Got caught by a Badlands herd once, said the drover, rising to his feet. Damn bovids went crazy. Sump croc had got into the paddock, started killing. Bovids ran like hell, broke open the gate, came thundering down on me like the wrath of the God Emperor.
A stampede, said Mulgravia, now on her feet too. Farcombe had shuffled to the other end of the bar to remonstrate with the owner, his harem and the violently predisposed Karata following in train. Plenty of other patrons still loitered near the entrance, and they turned in eerie synchronicity at the steadily loudening clamour. The bar floor shook. It began like heavy hail. A dense thud hit the outer walls of the bar, then another and another, until a rattling thunder of mortar reverberations rippled through the brickwork. Cataracts of dust spilled from rafters, shutters dented, pale fingers reaching through the razor-edged gaps in the metal. It kept on going, impact after impact, like a flock of suicidal raptors striking a viewport. Bones broke, slicks of blood oozed through the cracks in the battered shutters. Mulgravia bellowed at the barkeep, "Shut the damn entrance!" But it was much too late for that. The patrons nearest the entrance started to run, but then something spilled in. Hurtling through the gaping doorway, careening off the sides of booths and each other, creatures with pale skin and fever-red eyes sprang upon the hapless serfs, scriveners and hawkers. A slaughter began. Teeth bit skin, nails clawed hair, fingers dug into flesh. Bloody, raw gobbets clutched in skeletal hands were held up like offerings and devoured. A foaming red frenzy descended, undercut by screaming. Muzzle flare from the drover's auto pistols lit up the horror in stuttering, monochrome bursts. The heavy boom of Mulgravia's stubber joined it,
Her heart was drumming, all her old instinctual training kicking in to keep her sharp and alert, to blunt the horror welling in her gut. "Close the damn door!" she cried at the barkeep, her attention on the pallid things piling through the gaping entrance. The ammo counter on her pistol clicked into the red. Barak heard the woman and was trying to extricate himself from the argument with Farkoum, edging his way to a panel at the back of the bar. No sole proprietor worth his salt, or still breathing, would set up a place at the edge of the Badlands without adequate precautions, and Barak was nothing if not cautious. He struggled to focus. Jaina was out on stage somewhere, and Verin with that damn theremin. How he hated that instrument and would have gladly smashed it to kindling but for the creds it yielded. Jaina was his priority. Even a glance of her face would have done, just to know she was all right. He'd had trouble before. No Badlands bar endured as long as Hallow's End without a few battles and a few scars. But this wasn't gang strife, or even overzealous proctors pressing their protection rackets. Barak had no earthly thought what this was that had come to his door, but it scared the shit out of him. Hands shaking, he fumbled the lid clasp over the panel and it got stuck. Shit! That fat bastard Farkoum raged at his manservant. Barak didn't speak the dialect, but knew a stream of expletives when he heard them. Then he felt that same ire directed at him, acutely aware of the patrons battering at the mesh cage behind him. How he wished Jaina was in here with him. He glanced at the archway leading to the storeroom out back. He had servitors in there. Hefters. Not fighters, but they were strong. Maybe one of them could... No time for that. Barak wrapped his meaty fist around the clasp and pulled, hissing a curse as he slipped and cut his hand. Blood leaked from the jagged wound. The rattling against the mesh grew worse. His patrons shouted, pleaded. Behind him, people were dying. He reached and grabbed a case off the wall, yanking it open. An old service model combat shotgun, a man stopper, sat inside it. The polished black stock shone, replete with sad memories. He wrenched the gun loose from its housings and turned it on the clasp.
Fucker!
The blast tore off the clasp, taking part of the lid with it. Trying to drown out the screams, praying he wouldn't recognise Jaina's voice amongst them, Barak threw the lever inside and whispered thanks to the Emperor as the mechanism kicked in. Chapter 6 Burning the Dead. Miga was gone, swallowed up like a town lost to flood and sunk beneath the sea. Forgotten. No one would come. The old structures meant to preserve order had broken down. Mankind had begun to eat itself. Literally. A sick feeling twisted Christo's gut. He tried to deny it, like a deserter tries to deny the firing squad's bullet. But they'd both probably die if he didn't find help. He took side streets to avoid the crowds. The rioting was everywhere. Habitats lay deserted, manufactoria empty. Even the great bell tower that stood at the heart of Miga and could be seen from anywhere in the township, calling the hours for labour, for worship, for sanity, had fallen silent. Fires had broken out, either started deliberately or through misadventure, and coloured the air with the scent of burning. Ash drifted from the smouldering pyres of vellum makers. The scent of crackling pig fat made him hungry and wretched at the same time. Although Christo passed a few other citizens, hiding in their dwellings or staggering around lost and dumbfounded, no one challenged him. Despite taking byways and half-forgotten tunnels, they could still hear the desperate clamour of the riots. Eventually, it became background noise that gnawed at Christo's nerves. Even during rare moments of quietude, spared from the oral horrors, the memory of it lingered so viscerally that he could no longer tell the difference. It haunted him, a heavier burden than the daughter in his arms. He went north, reasoning that both east and west had likely been overrun or else occupied by the gangs, and southward would take them deeper into the township and trouble as yet unseen. He didn't trust the protection of the proctors. It was possible there were no proctors left, at least not in any meaningful sense. Whatever had befallen Meagher had infected the populace. Therefore, the greater chance of survival was away from people. Christo avoided the Magtrans too, reckoning that large swathes of the surrounding populations of Low Sink would be headed that way. Even on foot, it didn't take long to reach the outskirts of town. The industrial and habitation districts gave way to wilder and unkempt terrain. Old agri-mills stood like ruined monuments, colonised by massive fungal growths, bulging at their ferrocrete seams like overstuffed fruit. Roads were choked and cracked by massive roots, and floating spores thickened the air. Attempts had been made to cut back or otherwise burn off the roots and fungus, but nature had repulsed every sortie and so continued its besiegement. A thick broom drenched the land here, the colour of dirt and reeking of loam. Christo had torn strips of cloth, first wrapping one around Corinna's mouth and nose, then his own, to fend off the worst of the smell. It was heady and strong, like bad grain alcohol. Mercifully, the passage was uneventful, and they soon broke clear, emerging into a rugged landscape of shallow metal escarpments and old rubble mounds. Here, the land swept up in a gentle ridge that overlooked the edge of an underlake known locally as Irin Mere, so named for its hue and the ferrous deposits that poisoned its grey waters. A jagged fissure in the ridgeline offered a narrow slice of the water. A few junkers and old tugs still plied the dead expanse, though nothing had lived in it for decades or more. They were salvagers, searching for sunken wrecks. The ships Christo could see looked quiet, abandoned. That was strange, the sight of the barges and their patchwork hulls creaking as they lolled on the water. A couple had collided, prow to prow, and nudged against one another. He dismissed them, and Irin Mere. The underlake was self-contained and led only to the hive edge. They wouldn't find salvation there. He needed to find the tower. An order of Hospitallers had built their priory here on the high ground. Called Saviour's Rock, it had harboured the sick and injured since before Christo was a boy. None were refused alms, and as such, the priory had garnered a sort of respect, even amongst the less salubrious types of low-hivers, that saw it ride out the vicissitudes of the years intact. Only when he smelled the smoke and tasted its bitterness on the breeze did Christo consider this indomitable history might have reached its terminus. As he crested the western face of the ridge and the scudding smoke parted, Christo saw them, fleeing. Fire ate through the priory, and shadows of the sisters danced in its flames, except they weren't dancing. They were burning, writhing, dying. An abbess leapt from a high balcony,